Yes, you are with Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES Network. This is Sterling Allen. I'm the host of this show, which is brought to us by the BBSRadio.com system. We have our guest today talking about MagnaGas. His name is Dr. Ruggero Maria Santilli. Dr. Santilli, welcome to the show.
Thank you for this opportunity. Yes, indeed.
Well, if I could maybe summarize your technology, you have a method of taking waste input, whether it's waste oil or sewage, and turning it into some kind of a usable fuel as well as heat for energy output in a highly efficient manner. You have prototypes that are built. You have some commercial installations. And we want to go into in-depth this whole process. Is that a pretty good synopsis?
Yes, it is. Quite accurate.
Well, let's talk just for a little bit about what kind of process involved here. How did this get started? You were at Harvard when you started on this technology. You're not necessarily the inventor as much as you're just a proponent of a process that's well proven in the scientific literature. Is that correct?
Well, let me clarify. Let me go back in history. Our technology is based on a submerged electric arc that is was discovered by our sailors during our Civil War. As soon as the metal ships were built, there was need to fix them, and that's how the submerged electric arc was discovered. Also, the submerged electric arc produces a gas that is combustible. That feature was discovered by the sailors. They used to throw matches on those bubbles surfacing the top of the sea, and they will see the that they will ignite, and there was a name I don't remember exactly, but like fire on water or something like that. In conclusion, the arc was known since 150 years. And the combustible character of the gas produced by submerged electric arc has been also known for 150 years. Despite that, as everybody knows, this technology never reached the industrial level because of very serious problems in efficiency, as well as ecological character. More specifically, if you want, if you use a conventional stationary submerged electric arc that produces carbon monoxide, CO, that in the presence of oxygen and a spark, which is the arc, combusts and turns into CO2. Conclusion, the gas produced by this method is very high CO2 content, that I have measured even up to 15% CO2 content in the gas prior to combustion. Namely, the gas is absolutely unacceptable on environmental grounds, and also the cost of the gas is prohibitive, so with the conventional submerged arc. So those essentially are the basics. Now, your question is, your comment was correct. My effort initiated when I was at Harvard University back in the 80s, and I already had
Let me jump in here if I could and
sure.
Just reiterate,
please.
To make sure I understood what you said. You said that this was actually discovered back during the Civil War in the United States when they were underwater craft, when they were doing some welding on the metal underneath water that would produce a gas. But it's not been able to reach an industrial level because of some inefficiencies, which now is going to bring the question of how did you get efficiency. So continue your story. You're now up to when you were working in Harvard.
That is correct. At that time, I had paid no attention to the electric arc. But basically, I had the reputation of being innovative, and I received, this is true and documented, I received an invitation from the Carter administration to initiate quantitative mathematical and physical studies that will eventually lead to an American fuel. It is my opinion, and the President Carter, Jimmy Carter, is, in my opinion, is the father of alternative fuels, as far as I am concerned. I was, of course, very receptive to the invitation, but I put a condition, namely that I will accept the invitation, but at one condition, that I was allowed to seek a basically new way of bonding atoms together. My motivation essentially was the following, that the primary origin of all our environmental problems is not given by fossil fuel per se, but it is given more precisely by the way according to which nature puts together the atoms constituting a fossil fuel, namely carbon and hydrogen. And that that mean is given by the so-called valence, namely those are fossil fuel have a molecular structure that's made by molecules. The bond among those atoms is called the valence, is so strong that has prevented the achievement of full combustion for about 100 years. Indeed, every time you spend $10 in gasoline, at least $6 out of 10 are literally thrown through the exhaust in an uncombusted form because the efficiency of combustion is very low. This is due precisely to the fact that the bond is excessively strong and combustion has been impossible. So my condition for accepting those grants was to conduct basically new, and I have to qualify what by new I mean, basically new research that will lead eventually to a new way in which matter will to a new form of matter that that is essentially the need was for to combine the same atoms, but with mechanism and with forces that are, here is the key point, that are weaker than the conventional valence bond, namely structure, new structure, new clusters of atoms that are weaker than the molecule, and this as a necessary condition to achieve full combustion.
Let me see if I understood that correctly. You said that when you were at Harvard, this was during the Jimmy Carter administration, and President Carter approached your school, and you in particular, about coming up with some alternative fuels, and you gave him a condition that you would do this if you were able to pursue a new approach, and the problem being that with conventional fuels, the bond between the atoms is so strong that most of the energy in combustion is not harnessed because so much energy is wasted because those bonds are so hard to break apart. And you wanted to come up with a way of producing a new form of matter that has a weaker bond between the atoms so that this carrier molecule, this carrier fuel that's carrying this energy, when it's broken apart in the form of fuel, would yield much more energy and there would not be so much waste. Did I get that correctly?
Yes, absolutely correct. With the clarification, however, that I did not receive the absolutely great honor of being contacted by President Carter. No, the invitation came through the Department of Energy, directly through the Department of Energy, but it was originated by the Carter administration during the last part.
Okay.
That is correct. Also, I have to clarify that that the objective, they were broader than what the objective was, to seek new energies and fuels. And but here is the key point, to achieve really new, I have to clarify what the word new means. To be really new has to be beyond quantum mechanics, quantum chemistry, and special relativity. The reason being because all possible energies and fuels that were known in the 1980s, that were based on quantum mechanics, based on conventional theories, they had been fully exploited, identified, and by hundreds of thousands of scientists all over the world. So the chances So the issue that was on the table was the chances of really, it was a research proposal, the chances of discovering something really new based on old theories was virtually, in my opinion, was virtually zero. And so unless I was allowed to search basically new theories that will allow new energy and fuel, I was not interested. They accepted, the Department of Energy accepted them. And indeed, there was a series of papers, even the very, very first paper that I published in 1978, actually, and immediately started with the proposal to broaden quantum mechanics into a theory that will allow new energies and fuels. This under the new theory was proposed under the name of hadronic mechanics, where the word hadrons stands to represents all particles with so-called strong interaction, namely protons, neutrons, and so on. I was the problem was an enormous magnitude, so I left the Department of Physics at Harvard. I moved to the Department of Mathematics because the problem, you see, the way we scientists can only handle those region of the universe so small is by mathematics, and mathematics is our tool. Is our wrench and equipment. And so I spent several years at the Department of Mathematics.
Okay, let's interject here if I could. You used the word hadronic.
Hadronic. Hadronic.
How do you spell that?
Sure. H as hotel, A, D as daddy, R as Robert, O, N, I, C. Hadronic.
Okay. You're saying that the... when you talked about a new approach, you're saying that the existing quantum mechanics and special relativity had been exhausted by the scientific community. Hundreds of thousands of scientists around the world had basically tapped and had milked that for any all it was worth, and you wanted to go beyond that and to look at some new approach that was outside of conventional quantum mechanics, special relativity. And you began publishing a series of papers beginning in 78.
That is very true, and documented, okay. Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't want to dwell into the limitation, but I believe it is my opinion that American people are very smart and educated, and then they understand things, and if properly presented. So help me, for instance, to illustrate this key point. For instance, the quantum mechanics was conceived and verified to be absolutely correct for processes and systems that are called reversible in time, namely that if you change the direction of time from our time to the opposite direction, the process still verifies the law of causality; they are probable. This is typically the case of the orbits of the electrons around the nucleus of an hydrogen atom, for which quantum mechanics works magnificently. Indeed, if you reverse the direction of time, the electrons, rather than rotating in one direction, rotates in the other direction, but still you still have the hydrogen atom. Actually, the reversibility in time was a condition for quantum mechanics to be applicable to the structure of atoms, and this is part of history now. But here is my point. While I accept the exact validity of quantum mechanics and special relativity for this type of reversible processes, I never accepted and never will accept Einstein's special relativity and quantum mechanics for processes that are irreversible in time, because those theories were not conceived for that. The point of importance for this interview is that all the processes concerning to the creation of energies and fuels are strictly irreversible. So when you burn gasoline, that process is strictly irreversible. Namely, if you reverse time, it will imply that the exhaust spitting out of your exhaust goes all the way back and retransform into gasoline, goes back into the tank. This is pure what is called in academia mumbo jumbo. It's nonsense. It's scientific nonsense. So there was a clear limitation of quantum mechanics, special relativity, and quantum chemistry of primary relevance for our country, not only for our country, but I believe for society, namely the need to surpass those theory for and develop broader theory for conditions in which those theory were not conceived for. In other words, the statement that Einstein relativity is wrong is very unprofessional and will be inappropriate, because Einstein relativity was identified for specific conditions under which it works beautifully. We're talking about conditions under which that relativity was not conceived for. And so people who expect that the theory is valid for conditions not for which it was not conceived for, they are doing a political act that has nothing to do with science. No, science says what are the limitations of applicability of the Einstein theory. One of them, there are several. One of them is precisely they do not apply as exact theory for irreversible process. They are still valid, I should clarify, they are still valid, but they are only approximately valid, they are not exactly valid, such as in an atomic structure. This is of crucial importance, this point, for America, because still as of today, despite the vast participation of scientists all over the world for the construction of what are called covering theories, if you go to our National Science Foundation, and I did a check until a few years ago, the totality of the money that is dispersed by the United States National Science Foundation, to my knowledge, is strictly dependent on the exact verification of Einstein's special relativity and quantum mechanics, and the same is, to my best knowledge, for the U.S. Department of Energy. If I am in error, if anybody, any of the listening, anybody can prove that I am in error, I will rejoice dramatically out of my heart for America, because it is now known outside the politics of Einstein relativity and quantum mechanics that the point which has been conveyed by 5 grants that we receive at Harvard and then now developed in over 20,000 pages of published research available, talking about some 20 monographs, about 60 volume of conference proceedings, a couple of thousands of papers written by all over the world. The message is that yes, there is need to create covering theories. In other words, theories that include as particular case all theory, but allow broader theories. And this is point number one. Then this need is not only scientific, but particularly of social need, and in most particular, is of primary importance for America. Let me put a very, very straight the point. If America has to really, our country has to really achieve independence from foreign interest in fuel such as Arab petroleum, it is mandatory that we surpass established theory and we allow a due scientific process of evolution of the scientific thought. Einstein is a magnificent episode in the history of science. It will remain brilliant forever. But the idea that Einstein is the end of knowledge is nothing else but sheer scientific corruption that is very damaging to our country, to our reputation, to our history, and so on.
So let's talk about what you and your colleagues have been able to accomplish by going into a new direction. What is this science about? What are you doing with matter, and what kind of bonds are you creating, and what evidence do you have for that?
Well, this now becomes very technical, and there has been several monographs, but they are all post-PhD level. This is very, very involved because there cannot be real new science, near real new physics in this case, or real new chemistry. There cannot be real new science unless you have new mathematics. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just a gimmick. That was the point in which I was not interested to do a gimmick. No, I was interested in doing my best effort but only on this promise that I have to look for really new structure, which requires new mathematics. So we are talking about mathematics beyond the developed, well, initiated when I was at the Department of Mathematics at Harvard University as a physicist, and it has been then developed by many, many mathematicians all over the world.
How many years were you at Harvard after you started publishing in 1978? How long did this go on?
Number of 4 or 5 years. I received 5 grants, and then I received, Then we came to Reagan administration. All the grants and were truncated, and all support was truncated. I left Harvard. I accepted the position of president of the Institute for Basic Research, and I kept it ever since. However, this is America, and even though the government truncated support because of our enormous political, enormous criticism by the academia that I was working on surpassing quantum mechanics and special relativity, there was an enormous outroar of opposition. I could not care less. We continued our effort. This is America. We found support by individual, and not only we survived, but actually we prospered. Then we reached the level of industrial interest, and then we have reached now the status in which now which the Magna Gas technology is only one of the outcome emerging out of those efforts, in which I have to praise again. I will always praise the rest of my life President Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing will have happened without his vision.
So it was his these grants that enabled you to get the core research going, to wrap some mathematics around and get some publications so that you had the academic backing for the core of the research or the core of the philosophy behind this. And you're saying that this, to describe this technology is very difficult because it's, as you say, your money grants are a post-PhD level. So somebody who has an in-depth knowledge of the field is going to be able to understand after some lengthy perusal of your documentation. So maybe beyond the scope of what we're trying to accomplish in this particular interview with this particular audience. But do tell us,
yeah, if I may, I apologize on this point. There are now, I'm referring to them for a professional appraisal of our studies. People have to study this post-PhD, the level theory. However, the basic concept must be understandable by everybody. Because we're talking, you know, there's a distinction between the basic idea and then the technical, mathematical elaboration. The basic concept must be understandable very well. If they are not, it is my fault that I've been unable to express them. So, mm-hmm. For instance, the principle of Magna Gas. What is the principle of Magna Gas? This has to be understandable by everybody. Namely, the condition when we started was that we have the same atom as in a gasoline or natural gas, but we have to bond them according to a force which has to be weaker than the valence. Otherwise, we don't have full combustion. We just sure I got I would have had a chair at Harvard University, lots of grants and so on, but there would have been no advance in of this real significance in fuel. So I had to look at new. So then I started systematic search that lasted many, many years. What type of force? Well, the principle is that that force had to essentially disappear at the combustion temperature, because when we initiate combustion, the atoms have to separate so as to allow full combustion. So this was a necessity. You see the sequence of concepts. So I went into a very laborious search of which force I can use that will meet this condition of essentially disappearing at the combustion temperature. The answer was one, namely a magnetic force, because all magnetic phenomena have what is called technically a Curie temperature, namely a temperature at which they disappear. You have a permanent magnet you put in your oven at a certain temperature. After a while, all the magnetism is gone. So that's why I went into the search of a new chemical species that I call the magnecule rather than molecule, where magne is M-A-G-N-E rather than G-N-A, will be magna, that's big in Latin. Magnes is for magnetic, magneticule rather than molecule. And indeed, this so I searched for this type of new species, and that's at that point the electric arc came into the picture. The reason being that the... am I going too fast?
No, go ahead.
There is at that moment, in other words, the issue was, how do we realize a new bond of magnetic type between ordinary atoms? Magnetic time, again, because magnetism will disappear at the combustion temperature. And the answer was, after long search, the answer was the electric arc. That's how the electric arc at that moment came into the picture, quite late in the investigation. The reason being that this the reason being that to create a magnetic atoms are neutrals, and they have no electrical magnetic fields. So in order the magnetic field had to be created in the atom, and this can be created by deforming the orbits. Think about, for instance, an hydrogen atom. Normally it's a sphere, and therefore you cannot. There's nothing you can do. It's a zero magnetic field and zero electric charge. However, if you squeeze, so to say, the orbit from a spherical, from a sphere into a plane or a toroid, technically a toroid, but suppose you flatten the atom, immediately there is a very strong magnetic field that emerge, which is due to the rotation of the electrons in this orbit, in this flat orbit, and you create a magnetic field.
And so let me try and capture what I hear you saying. You're talking about the formation of a new species here. By the way, we have at the bottom of the hour, we're going to have, we just got a beep. Xenia is going to be giving us a brief idea of how we can decrease our energy footprint on the planet. We'll turn time over to her for just a minute, but first let me summarize. Actually, let's go to her, and then I'll summarize what I heard you saying, and we'll proceed from there. So, Xenia, go ahead.
Please. Hi, Sterling. How are you doing?
Hi.
Good.
Great. Well, I've been really inspired by the movie An Inconvenient Truth as to what we need to do to help the planet as these changes are going on of the climate crisis. You know, all over the country, there's been record-breaking hot temperatures. And the scientists are saying that within 10 years, the temperatures will actually rise from 2 to 10% more because of the carbon dioxide rising in the atmosphere. Of course, no one person alone can stop global warming, but together we can, and there is good news. We have solutions to launch a new energy future. I found that some small changes in our daily life can add up to make a big difference. And I found to start with, all we have to do is change our light bulbs to the compact fluorescent light bulbs called CFLs. Each light bulb uses 60% less energy and saves 300 pounds of carbon dioxide a year. And plus the savings you have on your electric bills blew me away. It's just amazing. For example, a 100-watt CFL will save $77 a year on your light bulb alone, just one bulb. And it'll last up to 13 times longer than a regular light bulb. I bought four 100 watts. I have more than that, but they have a special at Home Depot that APS, Arizona Public Service, is promoting in saving packages. So four 100-watt CFLs were only $5.95. And any building, supply store, Walmart, have CFL light bulbs. I spoke with the well-known author Jean Manning at the Tesla conference in Utah recently, and she was telling me that she has had light bulbs for 15 years, same ones. My son also has an outdoor light bulb for 20 years. So if every family in the USA made the switch, we would reduce the carbon dioxide by 90 million pounds. 90 million pounds. I have some websites you can go to where you can learn more about the climate changes and CFLs. You can write this down, www.climatecrisis.net. It's the An Inconvenient Truth website. That'll show up, and go to the column on the right and click on Take Action link, Take Action. And that'll open to a globe and four choices. And you click on what you can do, reduce your impact at home. Go to the picture of the CFL light bulb and scroll down and click on the red print that says Energy Federation. And here you can learn about the different CFL light bulbs, and you can order online. The Energy Federation Incorporated has a list of CFLs and special offers for buying the light bulbs online. Also, you can telephone the Energy Federation. I have that number here, 800-379-4121, and they'll send you a residential catalog of light bulbs for free. The number again, 800-379-4121. So switching your light bulbs can really add up to big savings in energy costs for your house and, of course, your businesses. Just 4 100-watt bulbs will save $308 a year, plus all the CO2. I strongly encourage anyone who has not yet seen the movie by Al Gore called An Inconvenient Truth to do so. You may also check the website, An Inconvenient Truth, to see where it's showing in your area. I highly recommend taking your family and friends, and then you can discuss and make plans about what you can do together. We have a beautiful planet, and we must take action to keep it beautiful and healthy for all humanity and nature for our future.
Thank you, Zenya. I appreciate your tip.
Pardon me?
I actually have some great news on compact fluorescent bulbs, a company called Mialink, MIALINK.com.
Okay.
They've got a product that is really a killer product in the compact fluorescent field. And we'll be talking more about that on our website at freeenergynews.com and also on this show. Look forward to having you on next week.
Well,
thank you.
If I may, I would like to make comments.
Go ahead.
Yes. Is Tanya still there?
Zenya, are you still there?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Yes. Well, I want to express my utmost support for what you are doing. It is very, very commendable indeed.
Thank you.
And if there is any help I can do, please count on my assistant. However, I would like to add something to the mandatory need of what you suggest, essentially decrease the CO2, and this is the following. You see, unfortunately, Vice President Al Gore did not disclose in his presentation a very big environmental problem connected with the greenhouse effect CO2, and that is called oxygen depletion.
Absolutely.
In other words, what we have now in our atmosphere is an enormous increase of CO2. Question. Where is the O2 in the CO2 coming from? Answer, from the atmosphere. So for political reason connected to air travel plan, where our planet is currently suffering a permanent elimination, essentially, of breathable oxygen in our planet and its conversion into CO2. Conclusion, the control of CO2 in support of your presentation, the control of CO2 is, in my opinion, absolutely necessary for mankind, not only because of the greenhouse effect, but also because humanity needs oxygen to breathe, to survive. And when you go, you see, most of the heart attacks you see by workers in New York City, they are not due to the fact that they had a bad dinner. No, they are due to the fact that there was a local oxygen depletion. When you do a strenuous working, you know, with all those cars, if you measure the percentage of oxygen in a street, you know, in New York or in Tokyo, you will see the local oxygen depletion that can be also below what the heart can tolerate. Thank you for your presentation.
That's absolutely true, and I know there's a lot more to be addressed, and we're just beginning to tap into it to start with some education and some awareness, and particularly to take action. We need to take action immediately.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on, and we'll look forward to you joining us next week, Xenia.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you much. Blessings, Joel.
So back to this MagnaCule. Interesting concept. So you're this new species of not molecule, you're calling it a MagnaCule. You're taking basically magnetically neutral individual atoms, and you are disforming the orbit so that they become a magnetic type of species. Now talk about what does that do in terms of energy generation, energy yield?
Yes, well, let's clarify the arc. The reason for that's why we arrived at the arc is that in order to deform the orbits of the electrons in an atom, there is the need of an enormously powerful magnetic field, so powerful that are 1 million times stronger than the biggest magnetic field we have in America, which is here at the Magnet Laboratory in Tallahassee, Florida. So, you know, that enormous magnet will do nothing of that sort. So you do the calculations, and only an electric arc has the strength of the magnetic field suitable for that job. But that's why the electric arc originated the MagnaGuard technology. And because at the atomic distance from the electric arc, at atomic distance or whatever, those magnetic fields are enormously strong. They essentially flatten the atoms. You create this little magnet, and this little magnet, they stick together, and they form MagnaGuard. And then when the MagnaGuard reaches combustion, the combustion temperature, as we know, all magnetic effects disappear, the orbits return to be spherical. But here is the point. While a carbon atom in MagnaGuard is isolated at the moment of combustion and ready to burn, the same carbon atom in gasoline is not ready to burn, so the engine has to first break the valence bond. That's where most of the energy goes, and the dissipation and the waste goes, and then finally. So this is why MagnaGuard is a fuel, the first fuel that I know, allowing full combustion, absolutely full combustion. This means that all the dollars that you spend in MagnaGuard are truly converted into usable energy, while in gasoline, only the 35 or 38% of the money turns out into usable energy.
So you have an input stream of atoms, and that is, you're converting those atoms, you're smashing the atoms through this electric arc, and creating...
We are not smashing. We are just only flattening them. When you have an atom exposed to a strong magnetic field, north-south, the electrons have to rearrange themselves to orbit in a circular orbit so as to oppose, to create an opposing magnetic field. This is a physical law. So just that flattened.
Are they maintaining that flattened state?
Individually, no. The moment you release the magnetic field, instantly the temperature will return to be spherical. However, when they are coupled, imagine if you have two of them, two flattened hydrogen atoms bonded together with north-south, you know, like a chain of magnetic polarity, opposing magnetic polarity. When you have created the bond of the two, magnetic bond of the two, when at that moment you remove the magnetic field, instantly the pair... It turns to rotate in space like a sphere, but they rotate as a pair. You see, the temperature will not, ambient temperature will not break that bond. You have to reach combustion temperature to break it. So in that sense, the bond is stable at ordinary temperature and pressure and will disappear at the combustion temperature.
So you're taking two atoms, you've exposed them to an electric arc.
Very strong electric arc.
And it flattens the atoms. They then join together magnetically, and then when you remove the electric arc, they become collectively neutral again, but the bond that is holding them together is magnetic, not covalent.
No. Beautifully, way. It is much better than I can possibly explain. Thank you.
So this is a new form of bond that is not...
it's not a valence between the atoms, but a magnetic force. And this is now a new molecule. You're calling it a magnecule, not a molecule. It's a magnecule. This is then a fuel which has energy within it, which when you break that energy is a 100% yield of output energy for burning. So,
that is correct. It is very true. Demonstrated. It can be verified in our laboratory as well as our customers anytime. That is correct.
So you're creating this new, this fuel that you're calling MagnaGas is based on the combining of two atoms together in this magnetic fashion, which when they are broken apart in a combustion process yields a 100% energy output rather than the 40% that we'll see in fossil fuel burning because it's so hard to break those covalent bonds.
That is correct.
Okay, so let's talk now about what kind of atoms you can join together. You're talking about an input stream of sewage, waste oil. What is the necessary input stream? What can you use for input?
Yes. Well, after predicting, discovering, and verifying this new chemical species of manicule that was verified at McClellan Air Force Base Analytic Laboratory in near Sacramento, Florida, for the first time, and now it has been verified in various parts of the world with special equipment called GCMS, equipped with infrared detector. After that, then we had to go through to the, we at that time we already had an electric arc, and so at that time we passed to the industrial realization, talking about 1998 by now. So we started, and so we put the structure of the technology, and at that moment, financial aspect took, of course, the dominant role over the scientific aspect. By 1998, had already been all developed. So the main point was the following: we're talking about 1998. The manicule solves the problem, at least in our view. It provides, you know, an advancement regarding the ecology, the efficiency, and so on. The issue was how can we create this manicular gas in an economic way? That was the issue on the table. And the answer came out to be unique. Namely, it's the following. one of the reasons why gasoline is expensive is because the basic feedstock, which is, of course, petroleum, is very expensive. We're talking about costing now approaching $80 per barrel. So the direction that I took was that let's use instead for liquid feedstock something that not only does not cost a penny, but actually the opposite. If we really want to achieve an economically viable fuel for America, let's say not only the basic feedstock doesn't cost, but also brings an income for its use. And that's how we went into liquid waste. We initiated with engine oil waste or antifreeze waste by using a submerged electric arc. It worked magnificently. And then, but those, as we know, they have relatively small income. You know, if you pick up, the automotive service station, they paid very little for disposing of engine oil waste and antifreeze waste. And then slowly, with the maturing of the technology, we went to other liquid waste that had a much bigger income, and we went to sewage, for instance. And by far the biggest income in the processing of liquid waste is given by the heavy biocontaminated liquid waste, such as sludge, which is condensed sewage, or liquid waste originating out of farms. And
out of which?
I'm sorry?
Coming out of which?
In farms, such as pig,
uh-huh.
Liquid manure or any type of heavy bio. The more the liquid is biologically contaminated, is infectious, the higher is the income. and consequently the lower is the cost of manure gas. Specifically, if you consider, for instance, let's consider a specific case, for instance, pig manure, which is liquid, is extremely infectious, is, you know, the farms, they have farms, they receive, you know, millions of the huge fines because of contamination, you know, of the area and so on. They cannot expand and so on. It's a major national problem. Our technology is industrially available now to process this liquid waste. We can demonstrate it at any moment, any time, with our equipment, with chemical analysis and so on. The principle is essentially the following: that we fill up our recycler, what we call recycler or refineries.
Let's back up a little bit. You were
please. Hello? Hello?
You have to pay for it to be extracted from the ground, but certain liquid feedstocks, they will pay you to take it off their hands. Engine oil waste, they don't want it. They have to get rid of it. They pay you to take it. Same with antifreeze waste. And you're saying that pig manure is highly infectious. So how much will they pay you, as an example, to take pig manure off their hands?
We are talking about several cents, you know, per gallon, and due to the efficiency of our recycler, this is sufficient to pay at least in part the operating cost. But
okay.
However, there are other incomes. There are five different incomes. In processing pig manure, as an example, it should be discussed so people can understand our statement that the manure gas is cost competitive with respect to gasoline. I'll be happy to enter into detail if you so desire.
If I understand right, not only cost competitive, don't you claim that it is even surpassing in its cost equation, that you are actually less expensive than fossil fuels at this point?
Yes, and I would like to elaborate why. Shall I proceed?
Go ahead.
Yes.
Yes, please.
So
the five incomes.
Let's review very quickly the process. This can be seen at, in our website, www.magnegas.com. Again, magne with M-A-G-N-E, not magna. Magne gas, magnetic gas, and .com. And then clicking there, is my email there, and I can provide to your listeners information which is not in that website. The website is mostly technical for technicians, but so let's see what the process is. We fill up our recycler, usually the small one, with 100 gallons of this highly infectious liquid, and everything is sealed. There is nothing exposed. This can be done inside. It is odorless. Then what we do, we recirculate with a pump, we recirculate this highly infected liquid through an electric arc. What does this mean? Well, the electric arc creates an area surrounding the tip of the electrode called the plasma. The circulating, pumping the liquid waste through the arc means exposing it to 10 or even 12,000 degrees Fahrenheit of an arc, let's say at 100 kilowatts. To have an idea, we are talking about the temperature in the chromosphere of the sun.
Okay.
To have an idea of the type of condition in which we treat. Also, as everybody knows, electric arc have extremely powerful ultraviolet light. If you see, God forbid, anybody looks at an electric arc at naked eyes with 100 kilowatts, he will be blind for a month because of the UV. So everybody knows that UV sterilizes. Conclusion. All those agents, extreme temperature, extreme ultraviolet light, thousands of amps, then all those agents sterilize. They do the following. They do three things. They totally sterilize the pig manure without any addition of chemicals, a point important for what I have to say for the income. So first of all, they sterilize. Secondly, all the substance, the biosubstance in suspension, are carbonized. They become black. And third, the residual liquid is partially processed in according to a complex procedure. So after when this is achieved by, not because Ruggiero says so, but we with this point is achieved by chemical analysis for each case, for each factory, we usually run one full hour of run and take samples every 5 minutes, give it to a specialized laboratory. They will tell us, Dr. Santilli, after 37 minutes, you can be sure that 100 gallons, for instance, are totally sterilized and can be touched. So then the machine is totally automatic. Then
is this a matter of running a stream of material one time through an arc, or are you running the entire batch continuously through the arc, and after 1 hour of exposure, all of it has been processed?
It is a recirculation. It is not a single pass. Since
okay.
we are talking about of extremely infectious, they may have up to 50-60% biocontaminants. One single pass, even though there's enormous temperature, one single pass is not sufficient to sterilize and carbonize. So it has to be recirculated. So it goes continuously through recirculating through the arc until chemical analysis indicated it is totally sterile and carbonized. At that
okay.
point, the equipment automatically discharges the sterilized liquid. Is no longer sludge. They lost even the odor completely. It discharges into a separate equipment, fully established technology. They do what is called coagulation. They essentially add a certain polymer that will coagulate all the carbon instantly. It's a magnificent chemical reaction, but it's not a contaminant. The polymer is natural. All the carbon is coagulated, so the liquid is separated into carbon and the residual liquid. That residual liquid provides by far the biggest income of the technology. Why? Because it is a liquid fertilizer. Not only that, but since it originates from organic bio waste, without any addition whatsoever of any chemical, then it qualifies for organic products, which is by far nowadays the biggest field of expansion and income for our agriculture as well as in Europe. I'm told in Europe they pay the equivalent up to 28 euro dollars per gallon for an organic liquid fertilizer. Conclusion, the there are five incomes in the process. Income number one is the farmer pays per gallon to recycle the liquid, its manure. Income number one. Income number two, by far bigger, is the sale of the liquid fertilizer. Income number three, even too small, but nevertheless it is an income, is the sale or use of the carbon, the carbonized substance. We use it, for instance, to produce electrodes, but it's a very clean carbon because it's impregnated with mania gas. We call it high coal, HY-coal. Excuse me. I apologize. So that's income number three. Income number four is a rather large amount of heat produced by this this furnace. That is a commodity. So the point is that those four different incomes already provide a significant profit.
Mm-hmm.
So when people ask me what is the cost of the cost of mania gas, well, the direct cost of mania gas in this particular case is zero, because you have an income even before by the four preceding income. Of course, mania gas will cost, you know, taxes, administrative costs, storage.
You also have to produce that arc. That's going to cost.
I'm sorry?
Producing that arc is going to cost money.
Yeah, but those four income are dramatically superior to the cost of the arc.
Okay. I'm not seeing where the usable fuel is coming off of this that you're calling mania gas.
Because when any liquid, thank you for this question. Your questions are excellent indeed, and there are so many aspects I lose. I cannot. So your help is appreciated. We go back to the sailor discovered 150 years ago, namely that a submerged electric arc produces a gaseous fuel. That's what the sailor did with seawater, but it turned out that basically this principle applies for any liquid. So any liquid waste, whether you have antifreeze or engine oil waste, or you have cooking oil waste, or you have big manure, any liquid, when it goes through an electric arc, then the electric arc will produce this gas, the gaseous fuel that turns out to have a molecular structure that we call magnegas. What is important
is harvested off the top of the substance?
Yes. Basically, imagine this vessel, which is a tube, you know, let's say two, for instance, a small one.
Actually, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're at the end of our time. Fascinating conversation. I wish we had more time. From what I understand, you're taking input waste. You're converting it into a fuel at a cost that is cheaper than fossil fuel processes right now. It's a new physics. It's a new process where you're creating bonds between elements that are magnetic in nature, not covalent. And you have this industrially developed so somebody can contact you right now and implement this technology for their waste stream. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having this opportunity. I have no words. Let me try. Let me say thank you, merci, spasibo, or grazie in a variety of languages. Let me say thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.